I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The American Beverage Association filed a lawsuit this week seeking to undo Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney's tax on soda and other sweetened drinks. It uses one legal line of attack that caught the Kenney administration by surprise. More from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
It has to do with Philadelphians on food stamps. One-third of the city's residents receive them. They're also called SNAP benefits. Groceries bought with SNAP, even soda, have to be tax-free. It's the law. And here's where the soda industry's legal argument comes in. If people on SNAP have to pay more for soda because of the tax, that's a big problem. Lawyers for the trade group the American Beverage Association argue that could make the federal government pull out of its support of SNAP in Philly. Hosea Harvey is a public health law expert at Temple.
As a matter of public policy, the ABA's argument is true. People who have who are SNAP eligible would be paying substantially more as a result of levied taxes for an item that they're supposed to receive tax-free at the consumer level.
But Harvey says, hold on a minute. The Kenney administration is collecting the 1.5 per ounce tax on sweetened drinks from distributors, not consumers when they buy drinks at stores.
That does not raise any compelling conflicts with SNAP policy as it presently stands.
The soda industry says, yeah, that's true, but when retailers pay more from distributors, what usually happens? The price goes up. So the practical effect is the same, no matter who directly pays for the tax. Zach Cowan is city attorney in Berkeley, California. That city has a soda tax very similar to the one in Philadelphia. Cowan thinks the self-interest of the soda industry needs to be questioned.
When an industry denies that they are exercising that choice in order to say, oh, look at this bad thing that's happening. That's terrible. Judge, please stop it. And at the same time, denying the fact that they're the ones who are doing it, you know, there's got to be something wrong with that.
In other words, Cowan says the soda industry gets to choose if it absorbs some or all of the tax, or if it's passed off to consumers. It should be pointed out that soda got more expensive in Berkeley after the tax. So if we assume the same thing will happen in Philadelphia, there's another public policy problem, the soda industry argues. A lot of federal money through food stamps would be going into city coffers. But Bob Inman, an economics professor at Penn, says actually that's not a problem. It happens all the time. Let's say a tenant receives a federal housing voucher for an apartment and the landlord's property taxes were just raised.
A property tax will raise rents, cut into the federal government voucher, and in much the same way reduce the benefits associated with the SNAP argument. So for them to make that argument just raises complications all over the place for all kinds of federal programs that benefit local residents.
City attorneys haven't publicly addressed the SNAP issue, but Philadelphia officials say they did their legal homework before proposing the tax, and they expect it to be upheld in court. Mayor Jim Kenney called the soda industry's legal challenge repugnant. Kenney says the programs the soda tax will fund, expanded high-quality pre-kindergarten for the city's kids, and improvements to parks and rec centers would benefit hundreds of thousands of Philadelphians. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
42,000 Americans take their own lives each year. The risk factors are well known, and one healthcare organization is mining its data to identify those who might need help before it's too late. Mike and Scott reports from WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk.
You could perhaps call this approach a reverse suicide hotline.
When people are under stress due to a medical condition or a life change, it's more difficult for them to reach out for help. So we reach out to them.
That's Amy Peters, the chief clinical officer for Able2, a telehealth provider. The company provides mental health care for people with depression and anxiety connected to chronic illness or major life events, such as the death of a loved one. Peters says every client is screened for suicide risk when they first enroll. Those who are at risk receive a phone call from a therapist asking if they are in crisis.
And if so, we are proactively arranging emergency care for those individuals who are at imminent risk.
For people who occasionally have suicidal thoughts but are not at imminent risk, the therapists arrange safety plans, things they can do when those thoughts come along.
The individual would know, I should get up and I should go to that coffee shop, or I should ask a friend to meet me for dinner, or I should talk to somebody I really care about on the phone.
Another part of the plan is removing all possible means of completing suicide, such as weapons or medication, from the client's home. Peter says the proactive approach is gaining momentum with other behavioral health providers as well. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
Now just 10 days out from the first presidential debate, let's gauge public opinion on issues likely to be taken up by Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, it came out this week that there are signs of an improving economy. Nonetheless, I do suspect that the economy is still concern number one.
That's true. We just updated our most important problem question this month. The economy remains number one when we put together the jobs, the economy in general, the deficit, all of those types of concerns clearly still aggregate up to the top topic from Americans' perspective. Following that, dysfunctional government. How many times have we talked about that? Dealing with Congress, this is the president, of course, not Congress we're talking about, but I think fair questions would be, how are you going to solve the impasse with Congress to get government working again instead of not doing much, which is what we get back from the public? Race relations, immigration, of course, that's Trump's big issue, terrorism and national security. Dave, all of those kind of round out the top five list on Americans' perceptions of the biggest problems facing the country.
The way you listed it, immigration comes in number four. That does remain Donald Trump's key signature issue.
That's right. Now, one of the ironies of this is the public actually, as we've talked about, is not in favor of a number of things he's proposed, like a wall or deportation of the 10-plus million individuals who are living in this country illegally. So they're not necessarily in favor of what he has proposed. But in general, that issue still percolates up open-endedly when we ask Americans about the top problems.
So let's tie all these issues and concerns. And as an aggregate, how satisfied are Americans with the way things are going?
29% are satisfied. That's a brand new number. That might suggest that there would be a clear desire to get a new party in charge in the White House, which, of course, would be the Republicans. But I should point out this overall right track, wrong track satisfaction measure historically doesn't necessarily predict whether or not the Democrats or the Republicans are going to have control of the White House.
With some trepidation, I'd like to bring up the topic of American trust in media.
Well, this is mass media. We didn't specify in this particular question what aspects of the media, radio, television, and so forth. But the bottom line, Dave, is there's no way around it. We are at an all-time low in Americans' confidence in the media. And the way we phrase it is, how confident are you in the media to report the news accurately and fairly? 32% of Americans say they are confident. That's down from 40% just last year. And we had numbers that were up, for context, in the 50-55% range a little more than 10 years ago in the early 2000s. So that's clearly down, and it's way down from where it was, driven mostly by Republicans. 14% of Republicans are confident in the media. That compares to 51% of Democrats, and the big drop last year to this year was among Republicans. Maybe they're following Trump's lead, because you know how much he has come after the media, saying that they have not covered the election process appropriately.
Attack from the left as well. Many Democrats are concerned that Donald Trump is not held to the same level of accountability and specificity as their candidate, Hillary Clinton.
That's right. I think President Obama in Philadelphia this week, did he not, said he was frustrated with the way this campaign is being covered. He looked at the back of the crowd and where all the media mavens, the media people, journalists were standing, said, I'm going to criticize you guys. So clearly, Democrats aren't happy either. I think Clinton has also criticized the media. But be that as it may, Dave, when we look at rank and file Republicans and Democrats across the country, it's really the Republicans who continue to be so negative about the mass media.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Delaware U.S. Senator Chris Coons hosted his fifth annual Opportunity Africa Conference today. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports.
The event connects Delaware businesses, faith leaders, and residents who are interested in Africa. It features guest speakers and panel discussions on topics ranging from trade, human rights, and sustainable development. Senator Coons became interested in Africa after studying in Kenya and traveling throughout Tanzania, Uganda, and South Africa.
Those two experiences in combination really exposed me to Africa, to the enormous heart and huge potential of its people, and helped me become interested for a lifetime in progress, the politics, and the possibilities of the African continent.
Entrepreneur and philanthropist Tony Elemelu delivered a keynote address. He said Coons' event is a small part of helping Africa thrive.
Everywhere he supports Africa, and not just about giving, but more about trying to help Africa become fishermen, because that is what we need. We need a self-reliant, self-dependent Africa.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
The city of Philadelphia purchases $3 billion worth of goods and services every year. It's trying to make that process faster and cheaper for both the city and its vendors. Details from Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segarra.
Standing in a conference room in Philadelphia's Municipal Services Building, Christine Derenick-Lopez drops a cardboard box on a table. It's about a foot and a half long, and it's filled with papers.
This is one bid to one contract. This is one bid.
It's a company's bid for a public works contract with the city.
And it's this is how it's delivered to the procurement department.
Derenick-Lopez is the city's first deputy chief administrative officer, and she's leading a charge to save money and time when Philadelphia buys things. When companies try to win most types of contracts with the city, they can't submit their bids online. Instead, they send these boxes of paper.
So this is what we want to automate and create a lot of efficiencies around.
Now, the city is rolling out an online platform where companies can submit bids. The city expects bidding to launch in November, and starting next year, companies will submit all their bids online. Philadelphia will also start using electronic signatures to speed up approvals on its professional services contracts by up to 45 days. Derenick-Lopez says the city's existing digital presence needs to be modernized too. If a company wants to do business with Philadelphia, there are six possible websites to find a contract. That's why the city is now launching a site called Contracts Hub that'll act as a point of entry.
Contracts Hub is essentially going to scrape all those different websites, and under one site, you can see every single contractual opportunity in the city of Philadelphia.
Companies can search by keyword, and they can set up alerts. The city's also making some internal changes so it can pay vendors faster. The fact that Philly's just doing this stuff now might make it seem a little behind the times. But a spokesperson said the city's in the middle of the pack when it comes to putting these purchasing systems in place. These new systems will cost up to $300,000 a year, but the city expects to save far more. And it says these changes will probably save money for vendors, too, which Chief Administrative Officer Rebecca Reinhart hopes will make it easier for businesses to work with the city.
And if we can get more local minority women-owned businesses to be able to do business with us, that could just spur the local economy as well.
Mayor Jim Kenney has said it's a priority for the city to work with those groups more.
So we're really looking at this as a great opportunity to move the city forward.
There's another benefit to getting more bidders. In the 2016 fiscal year, the city only had about two bids on average for every supply and equipment contract under $250,000.
For the taxpayers, that doesn't say efficiency, right? We need to change that.
So, big picture, the city's hoping that all these changes will bring more companies to the table, which will drive down prices on the many things Philadelphia buys. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY serves as the lead station. We're now some 3 weeks out from the deadline for qualified Pennsylvania residents to register to vote in the November 8th general election. The state's chief election official charged with overseeing the integrity of the electoral process is Pedro Cortez, Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Secretary Cortez, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Good to be with you, Dave.
And brought in, of course, under Governor Wolf, but let's note you have ample experience serving in countless elections under the then-Governor Rendell administration.
That is correct. So I served as Pennsylvania Secretary of the Commonwealth or Secretary of State from 2003 until 2010. So I oversaw 15 primary and general elections at that time, and three so far since coming on board last year with Governor Wolf.
And in practical purposes, you've been affiliated and actually served as president of the National Association of Secretaries of State. Is that an opportunity to glean what works in other states with the intent of perhaps bringing them back to the Commonwealth?
Absolutely, Dave. So one of the things that I did when I came on board in 2003 was to become actively engaged with the National Association of Secretaries of State, or NASS, because one thing I wanted to do was to be exposed to best practices, or at least what works in other jurisdictions that may or may not work here. So we have over the years used a number of good ideas from other states, whether it has to do with voter education, or it just has to do with the way we do poll worker training. So it has been a great opportunity to learn from my colleagues, some of whom are phenomenal, very progressive.
We'll keep politics out of it, but there has been this notion that there's the potential, and specifically with Pennsylvania being a swing state, the potential for a rigged election. You're smiling. Speak to the contention. No,
many times for the candidates that don't win, they don't want to admit that the voters didn't elect them. They feel that, hey, I have to excuse it in some way. You know, the elections was taken from me or what have you. So this whole idea that an election can be rigged is not based on fact. What people forget is, you know, first you have to be talking about the actual voting equipment, you know, to get rigged. And how do you rig that? None of our voting systems are connected to the internet. The machines are not connected to one another. And there's multiple checks and balances. The machines themselves are just one element of the whole process of elections, where you have a chain of custody, the equipment is locked and is secure. There's accuracy testing to make sure that the machines don't have any votes on them, to make sure that they are working properly. There are seals that are put into the machines, and they're not kept out of the sight of anyone who can check them. So the idea that the elections can be rigged as such is false, is what I want folks to think of. Elections are a massive undertaking in Pennsylvania, and I'll give it to you by the numbers. We have 9,200, so that's 9,200 polling places. We have 25,000 voting machines. We have about 40,000 poll workers. And I anticipate in this election we'll have about 5 million, if not more, voters. But when you put into...
And it's all between 7 a.m. and 7 8 p.m.
8 p.m., 13 hours, where you're having thousands of polling places, thousands of machines, millions of voters, and then you have this intersection of machines and humans. So it's a massive endeavor. And I keep track, the Department of State, we keep track of what's happening on Election Day. I have a spreadsheet by the hour where it tells me if there's any incidents that get reported by the public, by media, by my partners in the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Agency, the counties, anyone. And we log those reports. And for the primary this year, we logged 23 incidents that came to me. Out of that major undertaking
of
13 hours,
200
polling places and everything, I got 23 that I logged on primary day. And some of them were the polling place didn't open on time. Well, somebody forgot the key or they woke up late. There were 3 power outages, and then showed that the preparations were in place, because when the power went off, the machines had batteries, and then power was restored with backup. And so I'm not suggesting that elections are perfect.
But again, of those 23, no allegations of voter impropriety rigging.
No voter fraud, nothing rigging or anything. You know, what you do have every once in a while is what we call electioneering. Electioneering is trying to impose your will on others, particularly when you're already inside the polling place, to try to influence how you're going to vote.
Based on all you've imparted, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to walk us through the process. Secretary, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Pedro Cortez, Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Bob Balls and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.